Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to Sex, Psychics, and Psychedelics, Discovering Inner Liberation. My name is Banana Jane Garnett. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, a lover of freedom, and a relentless explorer of the mind. Please come join me on my journey in hot pursuit of inner illumination and liberation. For more about me, you can find me at The Banana Jane on Instagram. Now let's dive in. My next guest is intuitive reader Mattson McFarland, a highly recommended Mahjong reader. He's been specializing in depth and accuracy in his readings for 25 years. Mattson and I today are going to talk about the art of asking good questions, something applicable not only to psychic readings, but to all interactions. I'm really excited to have you here today. Thank you for coming on the show. And I know your readings are really unique, having been told about them, having recently sampled one. I've never met anyone who reads with Mahjong tiles. Everything about you seems to be rather unique, so I'm very curious to get to know you more here.
Well, I'm really looking forward to our conversation as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So tell me what brought you to readings and how you discovered your gift for this kind of work.
Well, you know, it was a cafe in the 90s, as many of these stories start, I suppose. I had a friend and she read with these cards and I was fascinated by them. And I was 20, whatever, you know, and she could do these readings. And I'd always had sort of an interest in the divinatory arts and had learned a little bit about palm reading and various things. And when I saw these cards, I was very attracted to them. And over the years, I mean, that was like 30 years ago, right? And but over the years, I've studied a lot of different oracles, I Ching or tarot or various things. But this was always sort of the one that spoke to me. And I spent a lot of time with it over decades.
We're talking about the Mahjong tile.
Yes,
cards,
the Mahjong
right?
tiles, yeah. Which yeah. were very briefly in print. Well, they kind of come in and out of print now. As one of the many divinatory decks that were sold in, this was, you know, the early 90s. There's a man named Derek Walters who lives in Great Britain, or did at the time, and had this set drawn up, and he had them printed as cards because they're easier to read as cards, and had commissioned some very lovely artwork with them. And I've had trouble getting my hand on replacement decks over the years because I use them so often they kind of wear out. And I would just go for the tiles, but these illustrations are really beautiful on them and people really respond to them. And so I've replaced the decks over a number of years. Yeah, and then I spent a lot of time with them and went on some very deep dives with them and understood what maybe they revealed to me, some of the inner mathematical goings on of how things work within the oracle itself.
So when we're talking about oracle, what does that mean, an oracle?
An oracle is a place we can go to have our questions answered.
Okay, so it could be an oracle, could be a tree or a church.
Yes, but there's always the interface, and I think that's the real trick, is how do we get into a space where we are able to access the ambient sea of wisdom that we are surrounded by?
Mm.
And, you know, we can't, I think a tree probably does have all of our answers.
Yeah, I was leaping straight into, you know, what is an oracle for me? But yeah, I guess in terms of this conversation, I mean, you had mentioned tarot decks. What was it? I Ching?
Yeah, sure. Oh, well, I mean, I've dabbled in maybe all of the ones that I was able to find and play with to varying degrees of success. And this is the one where I found the most transparent interface and was able to become what I feel like is an interpreter for the wisdom of the oracle.
Okay, so for you, the oracle is a sort of transcendent wisdom.
Well, yeah. I believe that the universe is basically holographic and that all of the wisdom is constantly surrounding us all of the time. So, but how do we access that? You know, people practice things like bibliomancy, where they pull a book off of the shelf and flip it open to a random page and stick their finger on a page, and whatever that passage is the wisdom that they need in that moment, you know? And I've seen people who really have access to the wealth of the universe's information using these techniques. That's not my technique. My technique,
right? Or reading tea cards. Leaves, I guess.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I guess anything can be potentially read.
Yeah, it's a window into. I mean, is that something that's innate within us? Is that something that's innate to the cosmos? I don't know that I have the answer to those questions. You know.
Sure. Well, I mean, you wouldn't be alone in that, Matson. You don't have the answer to the fundamental question of the universe. What? So back to the ones that spoke to you. So they're like mahjong tiles, but as cards. So mahjong is a game, right?
It's a game.
101 is, yes.
It's a game that is based in the I Ching in the same way that most of the card decks of, you know, a poker deck is based in the tarot. Right? I mean, ultimately, it can trace its origins back to that. It lost the major...
Really? Poker comes from tarot?
Oh, yeah. There's, you know, there's 78 cards in a tarot deck, but if you take out the 22, which are the major arcana, which are the... They call them the Atu, or they're the kind of the principal personalities of the deck, you're left with a 52-card deck of playing cards. I mean, that's where... that's where the playing cards came from, is ultimately from tarot. And in the same way, these mahjong cards ultimately came from the I Ching, in the way that most Chinese oracles come from the I Ching, you know?
And the I Ching is?
It's called the Book of Changes, and it's sort of a fundamental Chinese mystical text, I guess that might be a way of summarizing it. The I Ching talks. It divides the world into 64 hexagrams, which in a hexagram is six combinations of either a connected line or an unconnected line. And so there are 64 stations or channels of the universe, and the way that those combine and intercombine create the fabric of the universe. Something like
that. I mean, that's nuts. So interesting. I mean, why 64? And do we have any idea how this came into being?
Well, Lo Shu, the Chinese sage, said that a turtle crawled out of a river with this pattern on the back, and he saw the pattern on the turtle and thus intuited the true nature of the I Ching. So that's our best origin story.
I mean, dude, were there any psychedelics involved? I mean,
right?
Totally. Amazing. Amazing.
But it's appealed, I Ching has appealed to a number of Western mathematicians over the years. It has a very elegant and simple mathematical structure on kind of a digital level. And, you know, there's a lot of math in oracles. I mean, exactly why and how. I mean, I suppose I have my ideas, but that's headed into the very deep end of the conversation.
Well, I think we can go a little deep. I mean, I love all this mapping because it helps us sort of know what we're talking about. Some people listening are going to, you know about these decks and concepts, and others not at all. So it's beautiful to have that educational aspect. But what is the deep bit that you're wondering about?
Well, I guess that, like, why is it that a deck of cards, a deck of tiles, a collection of symbols can reflect the entire cosmos? How does that happen? I mean, in a certain way, we can think of our alphabet in the same way. We have 26 values, which are essentially able to encompass the width and breadth of the cosmos. Like, this is a pretty amazing thing when we go to think about it.
And numbers also.
Yes.
Numbers. That's a real distillation of the universe.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when we go into the there's a guy named Paul Foster Case who did a lot of research with the tarot, and he had this idea called the cube of space. And I was looking at a lot of these ways in which he was able to map the deck of the tarot onto a cube, and I was thinking about this, and then like it descended like a thunderclap, this understanding of the nature of Mahjong in a similar way as a magical cube, and you could map all of the suits of the cards on it, and that if you took the numbers and it all made this magic square, which then turned into these magic cubes, and it had this intensely mathematical nature that was, it's not about, I mean, math is sort of, I mean, we can call it a symbol, but there's something like a very direct correlation. There's not a lot of a middle ground to mathematical representations, very direct kind of geometric.
The directness. Thing. Yes. And I noticed that when we did the reading, it was the least wishy-washy reading I ever, ever had. It was very much, you were like, no, this is what this card means. Like this card means exactly this and this card means exactly that. And I thought that was very interesting. When you said about the cube, I mean, this is probably going to get too esoteric, but the only thing I was thinking of that obviously has kind of a four in it was we've got, you know, the directions, right?
Sure, yes.
Northeast, southwest, so yes. That's a four. And then
called the winds in Mahjong.
Oh, okay. The winds of the north, the winds of the east, like
yes,
that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that if you were to imagine that as an X and a Y axis, and then you imagine the Z axis or the vertical axis, those would be called the dragons. And those are temporal directions, the beginning of things, the middle of things, and the end of things. And between those seven poles, that sets up what we might imagine as an octagon of, it's a double tetrahedron. You know, if you'll just give me one moment here, I have some little models that I have built.
I was going to say, so this will be on both YouTube and audio. So, you know, I'll try and speak through it, but it's also nice to have the visual for this conversation.
This
okay.
is a cube octahedron, and
oh,
this
Jesus.
Is a shape
this
that
is getting intense.
Buckminster Fuller made a great deal about. But
very cool. It's like a nutty Rubik's cube with triangles and symbols.
So these are the hexagrams of the I Ching.
Okay.
So what you might imagine if this, so this is a cube, right?
Yeah.
But if you had a pyramid, a four-sided pyramid on top and a four-sided pyramid on the bottom.
Yeah.
And you collapse those into each other, you would get a shape that looks like this. Anyways, the long and the short of this is, I think that Buckminster Fuller contended that the universe was built out of this shape. This is the fundamental shape of the universe.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it so happens that this oracle is built out of this shape as well. So maybe the oracle works because it's built out of the same shape as the universe is, and that they reflect each other. And there's a portal that happens as a result of the way that this shape rhymes with the shape of the universe.
Well, I love that concept. I mean, it's a little mind blowing.
It's a little mind blowing. But you asked,
yeah.
And so
no, I know. If I ask, I'm going to get it. I understand. Well, you're talking about the reflection. You know, when you did our reading, you set up these cards are so beautiful. We should look at them. They're these, you know, these red cards. When they're face down, they're red cards, and you spread them out in this big circle, and it's like a pool. And you described it to me as this is your reflection. Oh yeah, okay. He's showing us the cards now, which are really beautiful red cards with sort of gold on top, and then beautiful drawings on the other side, and things like dragons and temples
and ducks and
ducks. But let's not forget the ducks.
Let's not forget the ducks.
And, you know, mountains and yeah, I love the dragons.
One of the best things about life are the ducks.
Yeah, never forget those. But, you know, you described it as, you know, the reading is very much, you know, it's a reflection, and you're looking into this pool rather narcissist like, and, you know, you're seeing where you are at exactly this moment. What I liked about this is it was very, in a funny kind of way, very straightforward. It wasn't, you know, this kind of like, you weren't like just whipping straight into the future, which a lot of sort of psychic readings are about. It felt to me more like a kind of thorough mapping. This is exactly where you are, more like an orientation.
I think that's a good explanation. You know, I think that you you hit on something really fundamental there to these readings. That the pond that we stare into, I mean, essentially what happens in, as we sit at the feet of the oracle, as I like to say, is we stare at a pond, which is a form of a mirror, and we look at the reflection of ourselves in this pond. And I think that that physical relationship sets up the right dynamic to investigate what we had kind of talked about as what might be the subject of our conversation today is what is the nature of a what is the nature of a good question to ask and for?
Yeah,
exactly. I think that that physical relationship of how do we ask a mirror a question, you know, is the right place to start, and it sets us up for understanding the variables involved, understanding, I don't know, it just kind of sets us off on the right foot to be able to ask the kind of questions that we can get answers to.
Let's talk about what would a poor question be, a not so good question be?
Well, I think people will occasionally show up. I don't want to throw anyone on the bus, so we'll keep it nice and vague. But like, oh, tell me about the future, you know, what's going to happen to me? Well, like, all kinds of things are going to happen to you. And the oracle wants to answer all your questions.
How do you know that, though, Mattson? How do you know it wants to?
I think this is an interesting question, because I think that in some ways the most accessible framework to understand this in is this sort of like the genie that comes out of the bottle and you get to ask three wishes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is a folk tale that is so widely spread that it has its own subheading in the ATU folk index. You know, there's the way that people measure folk tales, and that there's a finite number of folk tales that are told, and it has its own subheading of like the foolish wish. And there's a million stories about people who wish poorly, who ask poor questions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The film
Be Careful What You Wish For.
Right?
Yeah.
The film Labyrinth was essentially an elaboration on, you know, Sarah asking for her little brother to be taken away as a wish, you know, and then she has to go get him back. Or, you know, we may remember this story about the monkey's paw, or there's this, you know, folk tales like the three wishes where, you know, a genie comes out of the bottle and the people are motivated for whatever reason to ask a question out of desperation. Like, oh, we're so hungry. If only we had a sausage to eat for dinner. And then a sausage appears. And then, you know, one of the two people there, it's often a husband and a wife in these stories, says, oh, you're so stupid. Why did you ask for a sausage? I wish that sausage was just stuck to the end of your nose. And so then the sausage gets stuck to the end of the nose of one of the partners, and then they're trying to tug it off and pull, and they can't get it off. And then finally, out of desperation, they expend their last wish to get the sausage off the nose, and this is the end of the story.
That is a bizarre story, because why would someone want a sausage stuck to somebody else's nose? That was a wife who wanted to humiliate her husband. I just think what would be even better than eating a sausage when I'm starving is being able to like love you all day.
Right.
It's very
first
funny.
Wish comes out of desperation, the second one comes out of anger, and the third one is just like desperation. And then we're back.
I think desperation is really interesting. I mean, so the what's gonna happen to me question.
Yes.
You know, not only is that incredibly vague, but it's also very disempowered.
Well, it's also like, what's going to happen to you? Well, you're going to have good days. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have the entire arc of human emotions. Like, what is our framework for setting this up? Or people will come and say, well, what's going to happen? Well, what's the better decision for me to do this, or for me to do this, or for me to do this? And I think, well, how in the world are we going to be able to interpret anything that is going to be said about that? Like, if something's said, is that pertaining to the first case or the second case or the third case? Or like, how will we understand this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think what's going to happen to me feels to me, and this is, you know, therapist brain, but feels like basically, you know, tell me it's going to be okay. Like, will I be okay? You know? Yeah. And maybe that's the answer is like, ah, you'll be all right, kid. Don't worry. But,
I've had those readings by others and I have been asked to do those readings by people. And, those aren't the readings that I do. I'm afraid.
Yeah. It's not what you're interested in. So tell me, okay. So let's talk about what is a good question for you and what
you do. I think a good question is specific and it's focused and it's formatted.
But it's not a yes or a no answer, or is it?
Well, I can occasionally give yes or no answers, or I should say, I can see that the oracle is answering yes or no. But that's not really up to me, nor is it up to the querent or their question. You know, it's just sometimes the situation is such that the oracle answers either yes or no. More often, like if people say, you know, should I stay with my lover or should I leave my lover? I'll say, well, that sounds like two questions. And what I can do is let's break this down. What is going to happen if I stay with my lover? And then I will lay out a reading. It will say very specifically how it's going to feel, what the course of events are that are going to occur, what the situations are, what happens if you stay. And then we take that one away, we lay down another one. And you then can compare and contrast what each one feels like and make your decision from your position here in the present as the agent of change in your life to make a discernment between those two things and say, well, based on this, which I assume is accurate, now you can make your decision based on that.
I like that. And I like that there are sort of multiple cards around each scenario. So if it's, you know, because the reality is, right, should I stay? I mean, sometimes it's just like, look, this is an entirely toxic scenario and you need to get out of it, you know. But a lot of times it's, you know, there are some pros and cons. Should I stay with my lover? Well, you know, they're really good in bed and it's very comfortable.
Sure, sure.
Also, it's holding me back from, you know, developing something that I want more, whatever it is. But on each side, there are going to be, so to speak, different cards. I mean, there are going to be, you know, there are a number of elements.
Absolutely. Well, life is complex and it's not cut and dried. And if it was, we wouldn't need an oracle to consult about it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think back to where is the oracle? It does feel like, you know, it is also ultimately, it's everywhere and it's also within. So I think, and it's hard for us to be patient enough to do this. And I think it's essentially meditating, but you know, you can also have those two scenarios and you could meditate in each one and feel in your body, how does it feel to stay with my lover? How does it feel to leave my lover and sift through those emotions and sensations, and thoughts?
I completely agree. I think that many times, there's sometimes in my life when I just need to say something out loud to decide whether it's true or not. And like, there's another way of like having something presented to you allows you to feel a way about it or not. And I don't know that that's even like going to give you access to the greatest wisdom of it. I mean, you were saying, you know, sometimes it's really cut and dried about, you know, you need to get out of this relationship. But I can guarantee you, based on my own experiences, those people come back for another reading and they're still with that terrible partner, despite the fact that they were told in no uncertain terms that this is not what they should be doing. Because we do what we do, you know?
We don't always have the ability to make the decision that's best for us. I mean, we're talking about, okay, so we're now in this land of, you know, toxic relationships, and part of my training as a marriage and family counselor was around these kinds of relationships. And actually the counsel for the counselors is that if you find, and it's not always a woman, but often it is, you know, someone who's in a battering relationship, meaning they're being kind of bullied or abused in a way that is, you know, really not okay, and you're dying to rescue them and see them leave the situation, you actually never tell them. You never tell them to leave, because if they are incapable of doing that themselves, all it does is reinforce their own disempowerment. What you do is you empower them. So I think with all of this kind of work, it should be in service of empowerment. And somebody said that to me once, actually, because I had a reading and I took it back to an intuitive friend of mine, because the psychic had said something that really just felt disempowering. And she said, if it doesn't feel like it's coming from the spirit of love and it isn't empowering, then they're actually not doing their job.
That's right.
So what, yeah, what do you think about that?
I think that that's very correct. And where I go with that is I had a teacher pull me aside and counsel against, with conditioning the information that I was giving in certain ways. And what he suggested was that if you can see that someone has a major obstacle coming up and you tell them about that and they steer around it, are you doing them a service in doing
that? Yeah, great question. Yeah.
Our obstacles in life and our response to them are the jungle gym on which we build our soul, you know, that we need to go through the work that is there for us to become the people who we are. And if we avoid the work, we don't end up becoming the people we're meant to be.
So interesting. And I go to another place with this as well. Like if you see an obstacle in my path, let's say we're doing a reading today and you see an obstacle in my path. Well, you're seeing a likely obstacle in my path. You're not seeing a 100% certain obstacle in my path because the future is not completely written.
I agree with that. Yet, I as a philosopher, I completely agree with you. As a reader of cards, I have a moment of pause to say, it's funny you should say that, but it is what comes up in the cards is going to happen. It's going to
happen. Okay, so let's say you're right about that. Let's say you tell me about this obstacle. Let's say it's, you know, in a year, you're going to have a big surgery or, you know, you've got a big health problem coming up. I mean, I'd rather not know.
Yeah, ignorance is bliss.
Because what am I going to do? Spend the next year worrying about what's going to happen to me, you know? I mean,
well, this is
that takes discernment on your part. You know, is this helpful for her to know that if you see it?
I'll do what I think is sort of an artful dodge of something and have somebody come after me like, no, you need to tell me about this. And it doesn't do someone a service. It's a funny thing. I don't know, this looking into the future or prescience or whatever words we're going to apply to this. When one spends time in this space, it turns out the space is a really different space than the one that is commonly thought of. And we think that there are answers to be had by knowing the future. And it turns out that there aren't really, you know, there isn't.
It doesn't necessarily help, you mean?
Yeah, it doesn't
know the future.
Help. And well, it comes down to some really fundamental questions about free will and about destiny and about agency in life and about feeling at the helm of our own life and being the agent of change in our life and being capable of executing change in our life. And in so many ways, there is this script that we are just sort of living out in many ways. And that's our story to live. And our experience as agents within it is integral to that. But it's this very delicate balance. I wish I could speak more succinctly or clearly to it, but it's such ambiguous territory.
Okay, I have a good question. I think this is a good question. My ego is very attached to this question. What percentage choice do you think we have?
100%. But we are also destined to live the life that is ours.
Okay, that doesn't make sense. That's a contradiction.
Well, that would probably be a greater indicator of its truth than its falsehood, I would say. That it is.
Oh, you're going to do that. Oh, the mystics. The riddles.
Yeah, well, I embrace the mystery. I would so much, like on an existential level, I would be more heartbroken to lose the mystery then I would be thrilled to gain the answer. I do not view answers as desirable. I think that they are the enemy. I think the questions are our friends, and that when we arrive at an answer, that's when we agree to quit pursuing a line of questioning. And I think it's the dynamic questioning that is the pulse of life. That is us and our struggle with the cosmos. That is what is going to feed us. Answers don't feed us. Answers are where we agree to quit.
Be done in a way.
Yeah, to be done.
Yeah, yeah, and, yeah, 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 yeah.
And the
Oh, I like this. Yes, so answers carry this sort of illusory. It's really the arrival fallacy, right? That once I get the answer, I'll be able to put the anxiety down, I suppose. But yes, I like the idea of sort of, it makes me think of the word quest being inside question. And I don't know if that's, but yeah, the living in question is sort of the trajectory of questions, like sailing tacks, right? You set the sail to carry yourself in a certain direction. So yes, I suppose what is a good question? A question maybe that empowers you and excites you moving forwards. What do you think?
I couldn't agree more. I think that when we place the question as the place we want to be and take the answer off of our map of where we're trying to go, we elevate that question into something that's very dynamic, something that's living, and a place we can live. And if we can live in that question, I think then we're really living. I think that when we are waiting to get to the answer, to be able to like carve that out as a place to live, I think we are just setting ourselves up for disappointment. Any answer is going to be temporary. Any answer is going to be superseded by the flow of time and changing circumstances. There aren't fixed truths, you know?
As you were talking, it made me think of those kind of questions like, what would Jesus do? What would love do? What would the highest part of me do? You could go more whimsical. What would a butterfly do? Whatever floats your boat, I suppose, in that way. But maybe whatever it is that sort of elevates your thinking and your creative response to life as it comes in.
Yes, I love that. I feel like when we enter into that space, we are in a bigger universe. And that's a better place than a smaller universe, you know?
I agree, personally. I mean, I try to agree. It's sometimes the fearful part of me wants it smaller. The fearful part of me wants to know. It wants, you know, everything to be verified and screened and, you know, controlled. And safe, you know, but I don't think it ever really is safe. So that's all a falsehood.
Well, I think that our urge for control and our desire for that the comfort of that control is a necessary and a beautiful thing. I mean, who doesn't like to sleep in a little bit? Who doesn't like to be fed well? Who doesn't like to feel secure in their relationship? But if we pad ourselves so fully with those comforts, we cut ourselves off from something that's very vital, and we end up merely trying to protect our comfort rather than engaging the universe in some fuller way. But if we are just out, you know, raw dogging the universe, it can be a little much. And so, I'm gonna be the mystic. I'm gonna say, both my urge for comfort and my urge for mystery, I'm going to encourage both of them with all of my strength, you know?
Yes. I like that. The yes and being a more generative place to live than the either or.
It seats me inside of my struggle in a way that empowers me, because I feel like that struggle is something necessary to our souls. And if we eliminate the struggle, we will find a new way to invent it. And that is likely going to be a way of making ourselves miserable, I feel like. And why not just see the point of needing to struggle and empowering both sides of that, the part which both of which I want. I want the comfort and I want the mystery. So let's wrestle it out, you know?
Yes, right. And enjoy the wrestling as much as possible. I'm curious. I mean, you've been doing these readings for 20, 25 years, did you say?
30 almost now.
Oh, fuck, Jesus. Okay, so have you learned anything that you find help from doing the readings? Have you learned anything that you find helpful to apply to your own life?
People ask me all the time, well, do you do readings for yourself? And I don't really use the cards. The cards have taught me to look at the universe and the way it unfolds as a reading. And so most of the time, I feel like, I mean, it's not as though I'm not surprised constantly by life, but on the same way I can I still have a sense of what's coming around the bend in some way, in a way that I think we all do. But I guess the cards have taught me to let it be. That would be what maybe the biggest lesson that I have had is that many times I've spent life as trying to be kind of the author of my life, you know, and having a real active agency and the choice making that makes my path through life. And I think that has its place, but I think I enjoy being the reader of the story of my life as well. And I mean, that could be viewed as a passive kind of thing, but it doesn't.
I think I was actually thinking of it more as receptive than passive.
There's a lot of my life that is completely beyond the scope of my control, you know?
Well, aren't you unusual?
And there's a lot of ways in which I try to convince myself that it's not, you know?
Of course. Yes, of course. Well, I suppose you see that, you know, it's like for me being a therapist, I'm constantly sort of exposed to the navigation of insecurity and feeding that difficult navigation, love and support. And as I do that for others, I learn to do it for myself, you know? So you're helping people sit with questions in a way that I think is celebratory. You're saying, look at this energy, look at this dynamic, look at this set of excitements or obstacles through symbols. I think it's a way of saying, it is a certain kind of an embrace. It's not a, will this happen or won't this happen? It's a enjoyment of the exploration.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, not to make too far of an aside, but if I contemplate like the nature of Tantra and you take the sort of the end goal out of sex and the practice of sex, it opens a huge field in which to play. And I might make a correlation between taking the answer out and learning to love and live the question in a similar way.
Oh, I like that. That's very good. Nice one, Mattson. That's good. Very sex, psychic, psychedelic, sex.
I thought you might like that one.
I really do like that one very much. I'm going to think about that a lot. Living the question in a way that you would live Tantra without going for that result, that orgasm, which is great, but then it's done. So there's something I've been meaning to get to, because when I had a reading with you, you poured some whiskey for the spirits or something.
Yeah. When I always brew a pot of tea to share with the oracle, and then I pour a cup of tea for any ancestors or any helpers who might want to show up. And I always put a shot of whiskey in that tea because spirits love spirits, it turns out, you know? And it turns out
would it be okay if you gave them like tequila, or do they really like the whiskey?
Oh, I'm not a drinker myself, so I have one bottle, you know, to pour for them.
And, designated, yes.
And whiskey and tea seems like a good idea. Yeah, I'm sure that there are many who would prefer tequila, but I don't.
Well,
have
they'll let you know, presumably, if they're just like, I can't stand any more whiskey. So, do you see spirits? Do you see ancestors? I know you said when we had a reading, you said someone had shown up, and I didn't know how you'd actually seen it.
Yeah, my experience is not generally super visual. I think the first indications I have that something has shown up is almost always smell. I smell something has shifted in the room. I smell someone's.
What is that? Clairsentient? Is that what it is? Clairsentient?
I suppose that, well, the sentience is more of like the, as I understand that term, is more of a feeling. And this is specifically as a scent. I mean, there is also that kind of clairsentient, kind of like a shift in the energy of the room, or, you know, some people talk about temperature shifts. I don't, you know, experience a lot of that. I have experienced it, but it's not. Generally, I smell, when someone shows up for a reading, we'll talk about this. What I often smell is I'm doing the cards, I'm doing my thing, and then all of a sudden I smell the whiskey in the other cup of tea. And I have come to interpret that as smelling it on the breath of the person who has shown up to help with the reading. And many times that is an indicator. And then if I smell again, I can smell someone's scent or someone's perfume or someone's cologne. In in a previous life, I was a chef. And so maybe I'm super tuned into my nose, you know, maybe that's what it is. And then sometimes, it's not very often, but every once in a while, I will either hear something or I'll have a thought that isn't my thought.
How do you know that it's not your thought?
Because it's not my voice and it's not the kind of thought that I would think. It kind of comes at this oblique angle and it doesn't have any of the lead up thoughts that would have prefigured that thought. And I suppose the case could be made that it is my thought, but I have come to recognize it as what I call not my thought, you know?
Yeah, no, I think I can relate to that. Yeah.
I am not one to make the case for myself as a psychic. I don't.
No, I know. I noticed that. Yeah.
I have had enough experiences that people would completely balk at the telling of the story. I kind of don't believe some of the things that have happened to me, but they happen. And so, you know, I'm going to continue to understand them as if they happened because they did. But I don't know. I don't necessarily understand how or why or what that suggests about the universe. This is the nature of my thought, is to relentlessly pursue these kind of things. And I've kind of had to just let it go and just be like, sometimes weird stuff happens, you know?
Sure does, yes. We talk about the holographic universe, no matter which direction you look, weird stuff happens. That's absolutely right. Mattson, I usually wrap up with some kind of wish for your work and wish for the universe. So, I mean, when I say universe, gosh, I don't know, the world of healing, the world of mystery, I don't know, wherever you want to take those questions, over to you.
Well, where would I want to go with this? So going back to our original question of like, what does it mean to sit in front of an oracle? What does it mean to ask them a question? An oracle is a presumption of some kind of all-knowing being or field or a presence of information that is vast enough that we perceive it as infinite, right? And that we would ask this seemingly all-knowing being for something that we want, some insight or something. And as I was preparing my thoughts for this conversation, it struck me that a ChatGPT prompt is not fundamentally different than this, right? In some way, we're asking this incredibly powerful entity that we call an artificial intelligence, whatever it is, however we're going to think about this thing, for something that we want. And I think that the art of the well-asked question is really a good thing to put into this mix, you know, so we don't end up with a sausage stuck to the end of our nose.
Yeah, yes.
And so if I had a wish, it would be to invite us all to elevate the questions that we ask ourselves and each other and the universe. And there's a sacramental act of clarification that's possible in the asking of the questions as we sort through and parse through all of the variety of wants and desires and conflicts that we might bring to the place where we ask for resolution. I think of like early on, you know, now when people generate I Ching hexagrams, they do it a lot with the flipping of coins, but originally they would take a big wad of yarrow stalks and they would divide them and they pass them back and forth between their hands until they, you know, end up with either an even or an odd number in their hand. And that would be the way that one would go about casting a hexagram, is how they call that. And I like this idea of taking the raw harvest from the universe, taking the wheat and then sifting that for the chaff and getting down to the seed of what it is that is full of life, is full of what will provide us nourishment, is full of what will provide the next generation of the life of this plant, so that we can come down to the vital essence and give back what isn't that, and take this vital seed and plant that in our heart, and that these can be the kinds of questions that we ask, and whether that be of an oracle, of ourselves, of others, and that we just bring that kind of mindfulness and that kind of clarity to elevate the questions that we bring, because that's one of our special gifts as incarnate beings here in these bodies, is asking questions. What a beautiful job, you know? Let's make beauty with this.
That's a beautiful invocation, and I absolutely join you in this. And I have one more question myself, actually. Well, two, I'm going to land with where we can find you, because I know people will want that if you want to be found. And the other is, would you pull a card for the listener?
Sure. Let's do that. We'll start there.
Just one single card. Everybody get ready.
I am going to need to shuffle just a bit to get,
of course,
listener
to tune
in deck here. In the meantime, my email address is MatsonMcFarland@gmail.com, or my Instagram handle is @MatsonM, and you can DM me, and I do private sessions. My sales pitch is all of your questions answered for $100. So we do as many readings as you have to do. I do advise that once you get, like, once you're full, once you, like, your belly's full of an answer, that we quit, because eating too much is never a good idea.
It's just, that's right.
As tempting as a second.
You want to avoid indigestion.
That's right. Spiritual indigestion is arguably
it's worse. It's a real thing.
So true. Okay, let's...
Wait, pull it further.
The ducks.
Oh, are you kidding? It's the ducks.
It's the ducks.
just where we started. Okay.
Just where we started again.
Oh my God. All right. Tell us about the ducks.
The ducks are about intimate romantic partnership. Hold the ones you love is what I'm going to say. That is the if the oracle has anything to say to you today, it says, hold tight the ones you love.
Oh, beautiful message. Perfect place to wrap. Madsen, thank you so much for coming on the show. I just love this conversation.
This has been fabulous. Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a delight.